You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and a warm welcome to Midori House. We're coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson, and coming up on today's programme...
One of the things that we don't want to do is try to create laws that won't create or stop these types of things from happening. I think if you look to Chicago, where you had over 4,000 victims of gun-related crimes last year, they have the strictest gun laws in the country. That certainly hasn't helped there.
With not the slightest chance of Donald Trump dealing with America's gun problem, what hope for change? Well, one group of Republicans could be the key. My guests Daniela Pelled and Robin Lustig will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including should force have been used in the Catalan referendum. The senior figure in the European Commission wades into the row and suggests Madrid was right. All that, plus the Saudi king is in Russia and...
10 years after Northern Rock... Our economy is back on track.
Are we being too mean to laugh but at Theresa May? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. And a very warm welcome to the programme. My guests in the studio today, Daniela Pelled, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and the journalist and broadcaster Robin Lustig. Welcome both to the programme. No one has expected Donald Trump to call for a change in the gun laws, despite America witnessing its largest mass shooting in modern history in Las Vegas. But while those who wish to rid the US of guns endure a climate of almost total intolerance, could voices from within the Republican Party act as a force for change? There have been suggestions that instead of banning weapons themselves, the devices that allowed Paddock to turn his rifles effectively into automatic weapons could be outlawed. Well, let's discuss this. These are things called bump stocks, aren't they? They replace a rifle's standard stock, and it means that when you pull the trigger, instead of you just firing one round, it allows you to fire multiple rounds and effectively turns your rifle into a machine gun. This is a new idea, and it is a voice, isn't it, Robin, at a time when there is no point for anybody in the anti-gun campaign to even open their mouths.
It does seem like that, doesn't it? Because every time there is an atrocity of this kind in America, the people who would like to see more control on the use of weapons think now is our chance. And every time they're wrong. So there's no reason at all, I don't think, despite what you quite correctly point out is happening within some bits of the Republican Party. And indeed, even Donald Trump said there will be a time to talk about gun control. I have absolutely no hope that anything will change. I think it might be a good idea if people stopped talking about gun control and talked about these assault weapons for which, there, as you say, there seems no conceivable reason why hunters or gun aficionados or anybody else could have a legitimate reason for wanting them, other than they like the idea of owning a lethal weapon.
It is part, isn't it, though, Daniela, of the American psyche, of an American's DNA, to feel as if they can bear arms if they so wish. It's not just constitutional, it's a general sort of, it's almost a part of an identity.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I was discussing this with an American journalist colleague this afternoon, and he pointed out something rather interesting to me, that immediately after any of these shootings, the weapons that are used in them sell out. There's a massive run on these weapons. You can't buy a bumper for love nor money. And partly, I think it's the effect of it's in the headlines, therefore people think, oh, I want one of those. And also the paranoia that actually maybe this time action will be taken means that people want to run out and stock up in case their guns are taken away from them, which is illogical, but this is what happens. I mean, the idea of making these adaptations illegal, it really is just tinkering around the edges. But tinkering around the edges is the only, it's the maximum that anyone is suggesting. I've read suggestions of state measures, for instance, focusing on gun suicide, which apparently is the highest, mortality rate, gun-related incidents amongst rural communities, like improving mental health, provision to you know, agricultural workers. I mean, this is the ultimate tinkering around the edges, I would say.
It is nonetheless a start, Robin. The lawmakers said that they hadn't heard of these things called bump stocks until what happened on Sunday. It is an acceptance, isn't it, that they can do something without doing something?
It's a really very odd thing for a non-American to try to get to grips with. I mean, I think relatively few people realise that only a small minority of Americans actually own weapons. But that small minority own a lot of weapons. I mean, it's something like one-fifth, between one-fifth and one-third of Americans own weapons, which means the vast majority of Americans don't own guns and don't wish to own guns. The great scandal of this is that America's lawmakers, for decades now, have been in hock to the National Rifle Association, which has immense power and immense wealth and can destroy political careers if a politician raises the issue of in any way seeking to restrict the right of an American citizen to go and buy a gun.
This is the key, isn't it? It's all down to politics in many ways. The National Rifle Association pours billions of dollars into the Republican Party, and Donald Trump on his campaign trail said that he would do nothing and he'd just entirely support the National Rifle Association in his campaign to be elected.
Well, you need some kind of leadership to tackle this massive issue, which is on different levels. It is part of the American psyche. It is part of the Constitution, and it also is very serious politics, and there's very serious money involved. So even to chip away at any part of that, you need leadership from the front. I mean, we are resigned to that not happening.
We arguably had that, though, with Barack Obama. He was absolutely frustrated at every single point, regardless of the number of attacks and massacres that we saw. Every time he stood up, every time he shed a tear, nothing was done.
Yeah, he was willing, at least. There seemed to be signs that he was willing, but that still fell very far short. I mean, it's become a cliche of all these attacks that the question is asked, when will it be enough? Surely this time. And each time the answer is exactly the same. No, nothing is going to change.
One thing that we are hearing, though, is this rise in Republicans who are saying we need to do something about it. Senator Marco Rubio said if there are vulnerabilities in federal law that we should be addressing to prevent such attacks in the future, we would always be open to that. That is a strong statement and can be interpreted as a suggestion that there needs to be a sea change from within the Republicans.
Yes, it does. But I wonder whether it's enough, and I wonder how much purchase it has. I mean, the evidence suggests that most Americans who do own guns do so for what they say is self-defense. They wish to protect themselves from bad people with guns. They're good people with guns. They want to protect themselves against bad people with guns. In fact, crime rates in America have been falling for years and years and years. America is now a less dangerous place to be, but particularly women, it seems, are now buying guns because they feel more frightened. More politicians need to point this out to people. More politicians need to take a lead, as Daniela says, and say to people, you are not more vulnerable than you used to be. You don't need a gun.
Well, I wonder whether that leading voice does not come from within the world of politics. Walmart has pulled bump stocks from its website.
Again, I mean, I'm not convinced by the voices coming from within the Republican Party. I think it's a question, it's an issue of politicians making compassionate sounds and expressing empathy because they know, actually, this is an issue they're not going to have to tackle. And similarly, Walmart, great. That's a bit of that. I mean, that's a canny bit of PR, isn't it, doing that? That's not, it's people piggybacking on this atrocity.
But it is a suggestion that private industry, the commercial world, is prepared to make what many would consider to be a political statement.
I think it's a PR statement. I think that's as simple as that. Are they going to say, well, we're going to withdraw certain models? Are we going to penalise this? No. The issue is not these bumpers. The issue is, as we all know, is much bigger than that.
So where does the voice come from, Robin? Not according from the Republicans or indeed from the world of you know, retail.
I think the voice has to come from individual Americans, the majority of Americans who don't own guns, who aren't part of this cultural tradition. They have to say to their political representatives, we expect you to do something about this. We are not prepared to sit by and watch massacre after massacre of people, of school children, of concert goers, of all kinds of different people being mown down by people with access to hugely lethal weapons.
We'll have to leave that subject there because we now move to Spain. Because in the last few hours, Spain's constitutional court has suspended a parliamentary session in Catalonia that was due to be held on Monday. It had been widely expected that the Catalan president Carles Puigdemont was going to use the session to declare independence for the region. Who knows how the Catalonians will react to this suspension, given the violent crackdown during Sunday's referendum. But now the European Commission has waded into the argument about the Spanish authorities' use of force at the weekend. It has said it was proportionate. Daniela, did the European Commission have a point here?
Well, the whole affair seems like a kind of bonkers competition as to who can mishandle things worse than the next. I mean, the fact that Madrid's action, heavy-handed action, with the awful scenes that we saw, which I'm sure drove many, many people to vote for independence, was one thing. I mean, the king's address to the nation was pretty misjudged. And now Europe, which has been quite quiet on all of this, instead of coming forward and saying, right, we can have a mediating role here, get talking, saying that the use of violence was proportionate. I mean, could he have chosen his words worse? I mean, I quite understand the EU's concerns over Catalonian independence. I'm fairly sceptical over the whole issue myself. But it's like everyone involved in this made a calculation. Let's try and do exactly the opposite of what makes logical sense. And let's just try and make everyone really upset all the time.
The EU is stuck, though, isn't it, Robin? If it has to emphasise and celebrate the expression of democracy, because without it, the EU wouldn't exist. But at the same time, it does have to, has it been in the case of the European Commission's declaration today, it says that the rule of law must be upheld in order to preserve the nation states, which are elected democratically.
You can always rely on the European Union to get it wrong, can't you? Whenever it is expected to do something which might help a situation, you can rely on it to do the opposite.
Well, I don't know.
It would not have been difficult for the European Commission to say, we absolutely respect the Spanish government's right to uphold the constitution and the rule of law. We were appalled by the scenes we saw on the streets of Catalonia last weekend. There is no excuse for the police to have behaved as they did. We can never condone the use of violence against citizens going about trying to cast a vote. It may have been an illegal vote, so what? They were not a threat to public order. They were not about to overthrow the Spanish state. The Spanish government totally mishandled this thing. The majority of Catalonians, from all the polls it would seem, are not in favour of independence. That was the case. I'm not sure if it still is.
But it is arguably the European Union's role to the idea of subsidiarity. When a state is allowed to determine itself as much as it can, that the EU should allow countries to sort their own messes out.
Yes, but it also has a role, as it has acknowledged both in Poland and Hungary, to say to member governments, we're not entirely satisfied that you are upholding the democratic norms on which the European Union was founded. Yes, of course a government has to uphold law, but it also has to abide by basic human rights, one of which is the right to walk down a street to a local school or a local town hall and put a piece of paper in a box.
So would this all be made better, Daniela, if the European Union would gently wade in and say, we will mediate this. We will help you negotiate this. Everybody stop getting cross. Let's sit down and talk about it.
Well, I mean, I think I have a more favourable view of the European Union than Robin, maybe. But even so, I mean, it's not wading in gently. I think if anything, it wades in too gently. What would that be? It splashes in, maybe. It sort of paddles in. Look, it does have a role as a mediator, and it does have a role as a, you know, as a... not an arbiter of democracy, but as a gentle force, as a gentle force to say, look, guys, this is what you should be doing. These are the benefits, these are the advantages. And it's played an important role in Spain, which we don't need reminding of its troubled history. I mean, Spain has been a member of the EU for the last 30 years. It's been a very important part of that recovery from a very, very dark period in its past. So I fear now that we have slightly gone past the point of no return when it comes to this. as in many of these disputes, you know, just like a fight in a pub, you need somebody to come in and say, look, guys, right, let's just step back here and calm down. And it's very hard to imagine who is going to do that in this case, because European leaders are not getting involved
either. Well, I wonder if they are. I wonder if it might be the issue of the European Union, the rest of Europe's leaders. Macron has started to wade in. And we are getting the idea that perhaps as individual voices from within Europe start to pipe up, then we will get actually a stronger European voice. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure about that. I'm not entirely happy with the idea that that Brussels should wade into what is absolutely an internal Spanish affair, in the same way as Scottish referendum was, that wasn't illegal in the United Kingdom. Look, my first job as a foreign correspondent was in Spain, and it was so long ago that General Franco was still in power. I was there when it was illegal for Catalonians to speak Catalan, when it was illegal for them to show a Catalan flag. I remember going to Barcelona and behaving like somebody out of a John le Carré novel to try to meet Catalan political representatives. I was appalled to see scenes which reminded me of that time just, you know, a few days ago. And it is really, really sad that a country like Spain, which has changed so much and is now so much a better place than it was, reverting to some very ugly past behaviour.
And not least because some are saying now that the longer that the EU doesn't step in, the more ammunition it gives to people who are not fans of the EU. So you get a leader of, you know, the hard right. Populism will say, well, look, the European Union did not step in when Spain needed it. Why is it there?
I think it is very difficult for it to step in. I'm not quite sure what actual powers it would have to step in. But the idea is that it will provide some guidance. It will provide a calm voice. It will put out the parameters, lay out the parameters of what is acceptable or not acceptable. And as Robin said, that those scenes of violence were not acceptable. Politicians only ever use the word proportionate about violence when it isn't. You know, it's as simple as that.
And in the meantime, we have the news coming in that this parliamentary session next week has been suspended. This was supposed to be the moment when Catalonia declared its independence. How do you think things are going to play out tonight and the next couple of days in the region?
I just fear that tensions are going to go on rising, when in fact one would hope that exactly the opposite would happen. I cannot imagine why the government in Madrid is behaving in such an appallingly ineffective way. They are making things worse rather than making things better. I would have thought it would have been a much better idea for them simply to say to the Catalans, look, if you want to have your referendum, go ahead, but it is our duty to tell you it has no validity. It will matter not. It is against the Spanish Constitution. The Constitutional Court has said that. It's there. You can do what you like, but it doesn't make any difference. Let's talk about more autonomy. Let's talk about powers for the Catalan authorities. Let's talk about political arrangements. You have your referendum if you like, but it won't make any difference.
It is that difficult balance to strike, isn't it? Between furthering a little bit, between allowing an expression of democracy, which is effectively what a referendum is, but also conceding that this cannot be the way that each side wants it to be. There has to be some element of compromise here.
There are loads and loads of legal obstacles before this. But what they could have done is just sort of quietly gone round to the polling stations, even shut polling stations down by saying, look, what you're doing is against the law. You could face prosecution. Not stopping people, not attacking, you know, taking measures against the system, but not the voters. That's really what it boils down to, because now we've got sides violently opposed to each other, and I don't think we've seen the last of the violence. From what I hear from friends who live in Catalonia, feelings are incredibly, incredibly high. They were high before, but in a kind of metaphorical, you know, conceptual space, they felt very strongly about independence. Now it's reached a different level.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. My guests in the studio today, Robin Lustig and Daniela Pellet. The time here in London is 18:19. Oil and wars, not to mention a fondness for excessively gilded surroundings, what some argue will form the new alliance between Saudi Arabia and Russia. The Saudi king has arrived in Moscow for a visit that just 2 years ago would have seemed inconceivably, wouldn't they, Robin?
Yes, they would. It's really, really interesting what's going on. And I think it's a direct result of two things that have happened over the last few years. The first is that the Saudi monarchy was shaken to its core by the way in which the US administration reacted to the wave of unrest which swept through the Arab world in 2011 and saw that America appeared not to be committed to the authorities in countries which were its traditional allies. The way in which America eventually broke with President Mubarak in Egypt led the Saudis to fear that they might be next. They also very much disliked the deal that President Obama struck with Iran, because, of course, what obsesses them is their perspective on Iran's growing strength in the region. They also are interested in palling up with Russia, because if America is no longer going to be on their side, they need some other big power who is.
This is an astonishing potential realignment of geopolitics, isn't it? Because Moscow and Riyadh have been opposite sides on everything when it comes to major regional conflicts, Afghanistan, the role of the Muslim Brotherhood. But yet suddenly you look and you just think they're working together.
Oh, and they still are. In Syria, they're backing different sides, for sure. But hey, you know, this is the changing map of politics, and Russia certainly is a massively big actor in the Middle East. Now, it always had aspirations and was sort of tinkering in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process when there was a peace process. But now it's the significant actor in Syria. So it has great relations with Syria, it has great relations with Iran. You know, it wants to carry on being friends with people who are not necessarily friends with each other. Added to that, that Saudi Arabia and Russia have got another major interest, which is oil. And they want to avoid a repeat of you know, spiralling oil prices, spiralling downwards in the wrong direction. They can do quite a lot in cooperation with that. I'm not sure I agree with Robin about the effect of the Arab Spring on Saudi Arabia, because the Americans were pretty clear even then that Saudi Arabia was going to be the exception. And that I remember at the time talking to lots of activists in Saudi Arabia who said, the Americans make it very clear they'll support us if we campaign on women's rights, maybe, or some cultural issues, but the red line is the royal family.
You can drive a car, but you can't have a vote. I mean, this is the whole thing. This recalibration, Moscow and Riyadh emerging as a new alliance at the expense, as Daniela has just said, of the United States.
It's interesting that you just talk about driving a car, because, of course, just the other day it was announced that, at last, how absurd, in the year 2017, that we should even talk about this. But women are going to be allowed to drive a car. Fancy that. In Saudi Arabia. But yes, there is a crown prince now in Saudi Arabia who is young, who is extremely dynamic, who wants to change the country in many different ways, who is going to be taking over sooner rather than later, I suspect. And he is the man behind allowing women to drive cars. I suspect he also has quite a large role in this new burgeoning friendship with Moscow. I'm not sure how far it's going to go. In Syria, it is very hard to see how Saudi and Russia can ever see things the same way, unless they do agree that Syria is going to be carved up into regions of influence between different authorities. Assad, the Russians' ally, can have this bit of Syria, and other groups whom the Saudi have been backing can have other bits of Syria. It could be the beginning of a carve-up of Syria.
And in the middle is Iran.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, up till now, Iran has been the defining issue for Saudi foreign policy. But indeed, the Crown Prince is taking a very dynamic approach, not just to domestic policy, but also foreign policy. When I say dynamic, I'm slightly whitewashing it, because it also involves potential mass atrocities and war crimes. I mean, he's said to be the driving force behind the campaign in Yemen, which is a very, very high-risk strategy as well. It's hard to see just how that will end. As far as Syria goes, it seems increasingly people think it's game over and Assad is not going to go. And the Saudis, well, they can live with the people they've been backing thus far to their role is going to fade out. The Saudis haven't been massive actors in Syria the way that the Russians have been or the Iranians have been.
Have they been massive actors generally in terms of foreign policy? They sort of quietly get on with things, but they never come up and start to join in the great melee of speaking and engaging.
Well, Iran has been the dominating issue. Now also with Qatar as well, like trying to freeze Qatar out of the Gulf Cooperation Council. But it hasn't, you're quite right, they haven't been massive actors. They've got a huge military, an extremely powerful military, but it's all been pivoted around Iran. So it seems that they're like getting a bit more ambitious now, and things are likely to change.
Finally, yesterday on Midori House, we examined the catastrophe that was the British Prime Minister's speech at the Conservative Party conference. A set that fell apart. A stage invasion by a comedian. And that cough.
We will oversee the biggest expansion in training for doctors and nurses. And we... and we... Shows what good the Chancellor's cough suite is.
Poor Theresa May. The reaction from around the world has been brutal, especially from Europe. We all smiled, didn't we, when we heard that? And I don't know about you, but I watched the news last night and, okay, I had a good old laugh at Theresa May's misfortune. This effectively was just bad luck, wasn't it, Daniela? Are we being a bit mean?
Well, bad luck could be one incident. Bad luck could be a cough. I mean, that's pretty bad. And she made a sort of lame joke about it. Fair enough. Bad luck could be a prankster, a very third-rate prankster, giving her a P45. That was quite funny.
It wasn't bad, was it?
And bad, you know, and then bad luck could also be the signage falling to pieces. But all of these things together, nah, it's not bad luck. Two things is a buzz in journalism. Three things is a trend, right? So that says all we need to say now about Theresa May's premiership. She made a little bit of a joke about the coughing. Now, I think another leader with much more charisma, or perhaps any charisma at all, might have made a joke about the other issues as well.
Is it the end of her premiership? And because the equation has been made, Robin, between, especially in Europe, where effectively the weakness of a prime minister's trachea actually equates to a weakness of leadership, and she should no longer be fit to run the country because she didn't have a cough suite before she started her speech.
Well, nobody's suggesting she's going to lose her job because she had a cough, but Daniela's right. Politicians can't survive too much bad luck, and if you are a politician who has almost lost a general election, which you chose to have when you didn't need to have one, when your party really wonders whether you are about to take them into oblivion for the next few years, a party that desperately wants a leader who gives the impression who is in charge and in control, and then this happens. It's not just the cough. It's not just the set falling down. It's not just the prankster handing her a dismissal notice. It's the way she reacted to all of those things. She is known unkindly in some newspapers now as the Maybot, as if she is robotic. She has no presence. She can't think on her feet. Even before the cough, even before the stage set starting falling to bits, it was a dismally delivered speech. I watched it as she was talking, and I just thought, this is a poor...
The contents weren't great either. The contents of the speech haven't really been examined much, but I wasn't very impressed by those either.
I don't think anybody has paid any attention to it. There's something about houses, and that was that. But inside the Conservative Party now, we have loyalty in public, but concern in private. One person I spoke to, a former MP, said that Theresa May would have been a brilliant Prime Minister 100 years ago because she's a deliberator. She's not a reactive person. And simply not being able to wing it when your throat gives out isn't necessarily mean for you to lose your job.
No, I mean, sometimes the country wants a safe pair of hands. You could be you could be fairly dull, and that's reassuring, but the stars are not in the right alignment for that. Not when you have Boris Johnson acting the buffoon, and no matter how far he takes it, doesn't seem to be far enough. Or you have in Jacob Rees-Mogg as well, living up to another strange cultural stereotype, this old fogey. And really, the Conservatives should be battering Labour. Labour should be battering the Conservatives. None of this is happening. You just have to stand back and laugh, really, at the state of British politics. Otherwise, you'd cry.
Here's the bottom line. The end of Theresa May will be decided by Theresa May. If she's got the bottle to carry on, she will carry on because nobody knows what else to do. Nobody wants the job. If she's had enough, and there were signs even before this happened, that she was close to having had enough, she'll call it a day.
It's not the cough that carries you off. Robin Lustig and Daniela Pellad, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. My thanks to our producers, Ben Ryland and Henry Rhys Sheridan, and researchers Katie Watkins and our studio manager, Christy Evans. Stay tuned for The Urbanist at 1900 London time, followed by The Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, but for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.